It's a podcast for the 5th of July, a Monday. And yours truly, Bob McCown, along with John Shannon, as per usual, as we sit here. We have not, for some period of time, eliminated guests from this program and just the two of us yak about stuff, but there is a sufficient number of items that we probably need to address. And so we thought we'd do it today. So just John and I yammering about a variety of subjects that have come up over the past few days. And we will commence with the yammering after these messages. So I have no particular order, Shannon, of items to address. So I thought I'd just go down a list of them.
Okay.
On the weekend, Canada's potential Olympic basketball team was unceremoniously dumped in the semifinal of the final qualifying tournament, losing 103-101 to the Czechs in overtime.
With a just over 40-second bit of drama that I don't think many people had seen before, when Canada's down by 9 and they score 9 points to tie the game and force overtime. It was as phenomenal as, quite frankly, anything I've ever seen in the game of basketball at any level.
Well, that's all very well and good, but at the end result was another disappointment. Yeah. Yet another. And I mean, the string of disappointments for this this team and this system is almost incalculable over the last, 20 years, maybe more.
More, Bob. Since you touched on it last week, really, since Jack Donahue.
Well,
and that's mid-80s, yeah. Bob.
Well, there have been a few bright lights here and there, but, you know, the loss to Venezuela several years ago in an effort to get into the Olympics, which was completely unexpected. And now this one, which was similarly unexpected. Look, at if they'd gone into the final against either Turkey or Greece, maybe against, because they'd already beaten the Greeks, you know, maybe a loss.
Convincingly.
If a loss to Turkey would have maybe have been justifiable, but I don't think anybody anticipated getting beat by the Czechs. And let's face it, although Canada mounted a couple of comebacks in this thing, they were down big most of the way.
They got robbed by their 3-point shooting was ghastly.
Yes.
You know, that was, if you, and the Czechs were phenomenal. Particularly one guard was phenomenal in his 3-point shooting at clutch times. We were not clutch when it came to the 3-point play with a 3-point shot. And it hurt us particularly in the third, I would call it third quarter, but early part of the second half.
Well, I tweeted something out on the after the loss that got a predictable response from our friend Brian Cooper. We should mention that Brian Cooper is, I think, the CEO,
chairman
of the chairman. Board,
yeah,
of Canada Basketball, and Glenn Grunwald, another friend of ours,
yep,
is involved in the program. Now, let me state this: I'm positive. You could not have two better people to run this organization. They both are competent, both are knowledgeable, both have a long history in the sport. They're the best that you could get off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. Nick Nurse is an accomplished coach. He isn't the problem in this. Nonetheless, I offered the opinion that this loss would be damaging to this program in two ways. Number one, their ability to get sponsorship dollars, which funds the program, funds many of the things they do, and is essential to taking the next step. The second was less an opinion and more an observation that we may see some of these high-profile NBA players once again a little more reluctant to be involved in the program, since the program hasn't had any level of success. And this is not designed to be a slight in either way to Cooper or Grunwald, who, as I said, are the best there are. But I don't think these are unrealistic projections. This loss, as much as any that they have suffered historically, will hurt. And I say that because this was the most NBA-laden team Canada has ever put on the court. Yes, they didn't have everybody because of injuries. Mm-hmm. But more or less, they got everybody they wanted to come out for the to play.
They had enough to win. There's no question.
Well, you would think so. They did not have a seven-footer, and that obviously hurt them against the Czechs. But they had plenty of talent. Mm-hmm. And to lose again, well, what's your opinion on this? I mean...
Well, it's disappointing. I mean, there's no question, particularly when you consider what we have started to develop in our country. And I guess, I was trying to figure out whether it was the Wiggins draft or the Bennett draft when we literally started to walk a little taller, feel a little better about the level of athletes from this country that are playing the game and that wanted to play for Canada, because there were lots of athletes before this, but some of them refused to. You know, Jamal McGlure refused to play for our country for whatever reason beyond me. He refused to play. And that started a trend, Bob. He started something there. But this group of guys has gone through the national governing bodies program and has played internationally, the under-19s. And I hope you're wrong about them giving up to play. The frustration, Bob, and you could see it on their faces. You could see it on every Canadian face, even the 720 people in the building, was that this is such a different game. It's officiated differently. And that might be the biggest frustration, like being able to walk off the court so angry. I mean, RJ Barrett chased the referees off the court. And the question is will RJ Barrett, who's a key guy for this, and I suspect he will come back because of his dad being involved, and hopefully he will drag a few of the other guys. The frustration is will the athletes say, this refereeing, this officiating is so, I'm not going to say bad, but different than the NBA game. I don't want anything to do with it. And that's the real challenge of what I think we saw on Saturday. I really do.
I hope you're wrong. That's an education process.
These guys know. Though all of those guys that played in that are Canadians have played the international game enough now, they understand it. They don't like it.
And well, they don't like it, but they can't. You can't use it as an excuse.
That's my point. So you had
officiating in every NBA in any NBA game, and the same in the international game.
It's worse at the NBA. It's worse at the international level. But yes.
You also have to understand the way the game is played internationally, which is very different from the NBA.
Totally.
And you have to accommodate that. So you can't just throw that out as, well, we're not going to play because we don't like playing this way.
But I think that's the only way guys don't come back. I really do. Because I think there's enough pride in this group of guys. I think they believe in the program.
Well, we'll see.
And when you look at, it's funny, you talked about not having a seven-footer. I thought going into the tournament, they would miss Jamal Murray more than anybody. But after the Czech game, I think they miss Kelly Olynyk more than anybody.
Well, there may be some truth to that.
Yeah, I will tell you that when in watching in that second half, when they were down 12, 13, 11, you thought, there's no chance. They can't come back. Then that just over plus 40 seconds where they scored the 9, that was as excited as I've been about a basketball game in a long, long time. It was, and listen, Bob, in overtime, they were up 5. They were up 5 in overtime. That to me was, this game was in their hands.
Look, the expectation was that they would win this game and that the game against presumably Turkey would have been the difficult one. That would have been the only challenge that they were going to face in this tournament. And it once again, it didn't work out that way. They lost to a team that they believed was inferior.
Now, as we go to the Tokyo Games, let's be happy that the women are there. It's a very good team too. It can actually, I'm not going to use the word medal as a verb because it shouldn't ever be used as a verb. Let's hope they can win a medal. This, the women's team is going to have to carry the program for a couple of years while the men's team gets back on track and gets back together, Bob.
Well, and with no disrespect to the women's team, and I really don't mean that. I mean, I have nothing but admiration for the quality of talent and their ability.
It's a good team, Bob.
Very good team. It's one of the best teams in the world. But in sport, men's sports still rule the day economically. And corporate sponsorship is going to be a lot easier to get if the men's team is successful. Which is not to diminish the significance of the women's team. And I don't intend to do that in any way, shape, or form. But it is thus in all of sport. The NBA is a giant, and the WNBA is a nice little thing that goes on. It's no different in hockey. It's no different in any sport. You know, more people watch the PGA Tour than the LPGA Tour by miles.
Yeah.
For years, the major tennis tournaments paid the men dramatically more than they paid the women.
I guess
why? Because they were the focus of attention.
Because the quality of play is subjectively better.
Well, it's perceived to be better.
Yeah. And, well, that's
comparatively, it's better. Yes, most men will beat most women at a sport. But
the exciting part about this women's team and the Olympics is how much enjoyment, how much pride we got out of our women's soccer team for so many years with Christine Sinclair. How much pride have we really as a country been able to glean from our women's hockey team at the international stage? Those two programs have been remarkable. They really have. The soccer team and the hockey team have done magnificent for promoting the sport of women's soccer and women's hockey, respectively. Let's hope the women's basketball team can do the same. It hasn't even received enough attention, Bob, within women's sports compared to hockey and soccer.
And maybe there's a blessing here in the men's team failing once again. And now our attention will be almost exclusively in basketball on the women's team, who are more worthy at this point of that attention and deserving of that attention.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, agreed.
Sticking with basketball very quickly, the Suns and the Bucks in a somewhat unlikely NBA final. And I say that in a reserved way. The Suns, and you know I've been on the Suns bandwagon for a while.
You have, actually, yeah. As much as it pains me, you have been.
And I went back to those 8 straight victories coming out of the bubble that didn't even get them. They won all 8 games they had to play and didn't get into the playoffs last year, which I thought was bizarre. I mean, I know they only were in there because mathematically, if somebody else had lost all 8 games or whatever, and they won all 8 games, so they said, well, we better put them in.
I think that's how Montreal got into the bubble in hockey too, so.
Well, almost. But what they showed was that they were a young team with a great player in Chris Paul, who had not won anything and still hasn't won anything, is making his first trip to the NBA final, but acknowledged as one of the best guards in all of basketball. You put him in that mix with Booker and all those other guys, the talent that they've got, and this was an emerging team. Now, I wouldn't have told you I thought they were going to emerge all year or this year. But as the year progressed and everybody was talking about the Lakers, the Clippers, you know, maybe Utah, and then the Eastern teams, Brooklyn was going to be great. The Suns just kind of moseyed along and were really good. And now they're proving how good they are. On the other hand, you could have made the case that if the Bucks had lost in the first or second round of the Eastern Conference playoffs, they'd be looking for a new coach.
Yeah, Budenholzer would be fired. Yeah, there's no question. Particularly if they lost in the first round.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, no question.
And we discussed this, you know, briefly at least, mm-hmm. over the mm-hmm. course of the season,
mm-hmm.
that the star that was over his head had dissipated.
Well, he wasn't very flexible. He wasn't very flexible in his game plan, Bob. He went to the well too many times with the same play all the time. The fascination to me was in this series against, and let's face it, the Hawks, Atlanta was banged up. Atlanta was really banged up. But the fact that they didn't have Giannis forced a coaching philosophy change. And Lopez in game five was remarkable. And then what Chris Middleton did in that third quarter in game six was as good a third quarter or good a quarter as you've seen in a long, 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 long time. What we've seen, you know, we touched on this a couple of times with some of our basketball guys with Devlin, maybe Jack Armstrong early in the year, was that, basketball seems to be morphing back into a team sport. It's not three superstars and then fill in the gaps. We're seeing a group of bright young players work together as a team. And it seems to be working better. And certainly the last two games for Milwaukee, if I'm Mike Budenholzer and I'm going to Giannis and saying, listen, Tuesday night, are you ready to go? He says, well, I'm almost there. I'm not even thinking of playing him. I want him to come back when he's 100%. Because quite frankly, I'm not sure against a team like Phoenix, they need him that badly. I mean, everybody's going to guffaw and say, well, you got the best player, one of the best players in basketball. You better get him in the lineup. But I'll tell you what, the depth of the Bucks showed up. The leadership of the Bucks showed up. And for my money, they played a better team game without Giannis in the lineup than they did with Giannis there.
Well, I can't dispute the legitimacy of that sentiment. I will tell you this, the Phoenix Suns are a very, very good team and Milwaukee will have all they can handle against them.
You know, I would rather
have Antetokounmpo in the lineup than not.
Yeah, no, I understand it. I was trying to make a point. The other thing you talked about Budenholzer, I tell you what, Monty Williams, this guy, the last 2 weeks I've tried to read up on him, follow up on him. This guy as a coach has had his bumps and bruises and some failures. But boy, oh boy, do his players like him? The relationship between players and coach, I think it really means a great deal to the success of the Suns. I think he's a modern day coach. It's not a question of, you know, fire and brimstone. It's not a case of getting mad all the time. But it's creating an environment, and he obviously creates the positive environment with Chris Paul's help for Phoenix to become such a factor.
Other things. For those of us who are not big soccer aficionados, the fact that TFC has the worst record in the league and have now fired their coach is of nominal consequence. But it is intriguing that this franchise, who has had almost nothing but success on the field for the last 4 or 5 years,
mm-hmm.
suddenly has gone from among the best to dead last.
Mm.
And is the coaching change the reason for it? Is that the sole reason for it? Or has this organization been mismanaged to the point where they're the last place team in MLS?
You know, it's funny because the first thing that came to mind was they fired a coach, but they fired the coach because the coach before them was so good and he quit. You know, Greg Vanney, this speaks to me of what Vanney did with this team over those years that it was at the top of the list in MLS. And with Van, you knew that they were going to have to go through some level of restructuring and philosophy when Vanney decided to walk away. But the fact that he has, and now the team has struggled, I think speaks to what Vanny did, not necessarily what this last coaching staff did.
Well, perhaps.
And the other thing is, I mean, I'm one of those guys. I'm, you know, this is a team in exile, Bob. Just like the Whitecaps are in exile, just like, you know, Montreal's in exile. I'm not sure what you can expect out of, we've talked about it all season long with the Raptors playing 72 road games. The Blue Jays playing 162 road games. You know, the MLS teams with far less fanfare have done the same thing. You know, whether it's in East Hartford, whether it's in Salt Lake City, these teams have not lived in their own apartments, in their own condos, in their own homes. And they're expected to play at the same level of teams that are at home. And at some point you have to realize that, you know, COVID has been a factor in this, and you have to maybe say, okay, this is a time to retool, rebuild, rather than worrying about wins and losses at this point.
Well, are you suggesting then that they should not have fired the coach?
I tell you what, any person in management, whether that be the manager or the coach in any sport, if he gets, because it's the same in hockey. These are tough times to be firing coaches and managers. I mean, because the playing field is so unfair, particularly for those teams based in Canada. I just, there are times I don't understand it, unless that there was a huge disagreement with the guys, with Bill Manning and everybody at MLSE. I wouldn't know whether it's fair or not. I would say that, I'll tell you what, in order to do it at this time with the team in exile is rather, rather rash.
Well, one thing we do know is that the organization had a falling out with arguably their best player right now, Jozy Altidore.
Yeah.
And
whether that's on the coach, if that's on the coach, then that could probably be, you know, the cornerstone for why there's
he did have a confrontation with Armas.
Yeah. Right.
That much we know. But, and look, I don't put all the onus on the club, because let's face it, Altidore is kind of on the edge. He's a guy who has missed a lot of games, and I'm not suggesting he hasn't been hurt, but
I'll tell you what, I got to tell you, Bob, there's a bunch of our listeners that are absolutely amazed and aghast that you're speaking this much about the beautiful game.
So am I.
This is, when you said we're going to talk soccer, I figured for sure we were going to talk, you know, UEFA, and, you know, we got England versus Denmark and Italy versus Spain. That's all
well and good. And I mean, I hang out with a bunch of Brits and a bunch of Italians.
Yeah. Well, I live with a Dane. So,
well, and, you know, and they sit in front of the television set, and then they won't watch another soccer game until the next big event, international.
We're not any different when it comes to certain sports for the masses.
And look, I'll be honest with all you soccer fans. I'm not a big fan of the sport. I think everybody knows that, and I don't apologize for it. But TFC, you know, is a train wreck right now, and they went from being an elite franchise to a train wreck like that. And I thought it was worth at least mentioning.
Hey, the one thing I've got to tell you is, because I did watch England versus Ukraine on Saturday.
Good for you.
I did. I quite enjoyed it. And actually, I watched both the American feed and the feed that TSN was using, just to see what was different and how different the commentators were. But you know what I really liked about it, Bob? 2 hours and 3 minutes. 2 hours and 3 minutes.
And it's over.
And then I tried to watch the Mets play last night.
Well, you know, and I was going to go straight there, because it wasn't on my list of topics to discuss today, but the comparative is baseball. And, you know, I know baseball has tried to speed things up, but have failed miserably at that. And I'm not sure there's an answer other than seven inning games. And are you prepared to change the sport so dramatically from an historic perspective just because of time, time restraints.
Well,
and I don't have the answer to that.
No. Well, I think that the science of baseball has hurt the speed of the game. I think the networks have hurt the speed of the game. I mean, particularly Sunday nights, the amount of commercials between innings, between half innings,
absurd.
Is spectacularly ridiculous. So, I mean, there are lots of innings where there's more TV commercials than there is actual baseball action.
Well, but let me point something out to you as a former TV executive.
What do you mean former?
Why has it not hurt football? Why has it not hurt the NFL? Because in comparison, there are as many commercials in a National Football League game as there are in a baseball game. And we talk a lot about the impact of all those commercial breaks in baseball as a contributing factor. And it is.
It hasn't hurt the NFL, particularly on Sundays, because there's more than one game. And there's always something going on somewhere. And the gambling aspect in a single day makes it palpable. If you've been to an NFL game and do an NFL stadium, it is painful, Bob.
Oh, I have been, and that's why I stopped going.
In the stadium, if you're not 100% committed to your team. And there are enough people in every city to do that. Although if you go to Cincinnati, that's not true. The issue becomes how you stay focused for all those commercial timeouts. But if you're at home, you can actually engage yourself in everything else that is NFL. No,
I'm not buying that one. And I'll tell you why, because most baseball games are played at the same time. It's rare. It's rare that there's a baseball game played independent of all the other games at a time. Generally, it's either a 1 o'clock Eastern start or a 7:30 Eastern start or 7 o'clock now. And then there's the West Coast games 3 hours later. There's almost always another game that you can watch.
But they're not treated. And I'm crediting the networks for this. They're not treated the same way on any level that the NFL and the networks treat the NFL game.
Well, but they have 16 games. Major League Baseball has 162.
Well, but that's also part of it. You know, you only have to worry. I mean, Major League Baseball, I can watch how many games a day.
Well, you're a hockey puck.
And I get tired. There are times I get tired of hockey, Bob. Well, but I don't get tired of football.
Four, five, seven, eight games on at the same time. Most of the time.
A lot. But
most of the time, yeah.
Yeah, but when you only have to worry about it one day a week, in theory, even though there's, you know, Sunday night and Monday night and Thursday night, but in theory, the bulk of the games are still, it's a Sunday night, Sunday, quote, tradition. And I think that that's one of the reasons why the NFL can get away with it. There's a lot of bad football too, Bob. And some of them take too long too. But, you know, there's always something else to look forward to in that window that the NFL has created.
The Blue Jays send four, as it happens, to the All-Star game. Game four of the Stanley Cup Final. Will it be the last one? Shohei Ohtani. What a story this guy is. And how interesting Canadian tennis is right now. It seems that it always is, but winds up in disappointment. We'll address all of those subjects when we come back after these messages. It's McCowan, it's Shannon, as we just opine on a wide variety of things.
This is a Monday potpourri, Bob.
Thank you, John. Semien Guerrero Hernandez make the All-Star team for the American League All-Star team for the Toronto Blue Jays. And now Bo Bichette has been added to that team. So, for the first time since 93, the Blue Jays are sending four players to the All-Star game. That's lovely. The intriguing thing is three of the four are infielders. And there are two things that the Toronto Blue Jays need to get better at. One is starting pitching. And, well, maybe now bullpen. So there may be three. But their infield defense has been generally horrific.
Left side. Left side.
Well, a left side infielder is going to the All-Star game.
He's not going for his defense.
Well, it raises the question now, you know, with no disrespect to Bichette, because if you watch him every day, you got to love this player. I mean, I love watching him probably more than anybody else. I'm not saying he's the best player. And Guerrero is the star.
Why is that, Bob? Why is that?
I don't know. I love his approach at the plate. I love the idea of going to right field. I have for years said, if you're a major league baseball player, how is it possible you can't hit the opposite way? How is it possible that you haven't been taught how to hold your hands back and go to the opposite field? And especially now with all these radical shifts.
Pedigree.
I sit there and I look at a massive hole for a right-hand hitter at second base and say, just put your bat on the ball and aim it over there. There's no one to get it. It doesn't matter how hard you hit it. You just got to get it past the pitcher, and it's going to be a base hit. And, of course, none of them can do it except Bichette. And Bichette, with power, almost invariably pulls the ball, so we know he can do that. But he has gotten to the point where he's hit so many to right field,
sure,
both line drives and lame ducks that have wound up as doubles or triples. He's doing it on purpose.
Oh, yeah, but it does.
He ought to be teaching his friends.
It does speak to his pedigree, though, Bob, don't you think?
No, I tell you what, John, I think he was a dead pull hitter when he came up, and I think he learned. And maybe he learned because he's so aggressive in the early in the count that he winds up with two strikes on him all the time. And one of the things his dad obviously taught him, or some coach, is when you get two strikes, shorten your swing, shorten your stride.
Right.
Don't lift your leg up in that big kick.
Just put the ball in play.
Put the ball in play.
Yeah.
My coaches used to tell us to grip the bat up an inch off from the end of the bat. You know, shorten up on your swing, on your grip. But whatever the message actually is, more than anybody else, he's absorbed it. And that's why he's going to the All-Star game. Sure as hell isn't his defensive play.
No.
And it raises a question to me, too. You have an All-Star caliber second baseman right now who is an All-Star caliber shortstop. And is Bichette going to be – would Bichette be better at second base than he is at shortstop? I don't know, but most guys seem to be. You know, if he can't play shortstop, the next maybe third base – Oof. Is Bichette got enough power to be an everyday third baseman? Or is he better off playing at second and let Semien play at short? Because, you know, there's more ground balls to the shortstop than there are to the second baseman.
I was going to say, if you put in order the four infield positions of which is the easiest to play, I mean, second base would be the easiest, wouldn't it?
I think most people would. Defensively, I think most people would say first base.
Well, but I you're right. No, okay. I made the assumption that we were leaving Vladdy there. So the other three.
Well, we are, but
yeah, you know. the other three, then you would put your weakest of the three if he can play the position, the weakest of the three at second base, and then. But you wonder with the Semien thing, because would you think that was a deal they made with Semien, an unspoken deal that say, hey, listen, we need you to play second base, and he says, I only want to play second base. That was part of the deal they made?
Oh, I think they were clear when they went to sign him, because he signed as a free agent.
Right.
And so you didn't have to, you had the opportunity to talk to him in advance. And it would have been very misleading of them to say, this is a guy who played shortstop his whole career. To say, you know, okay, we're going to bring you over to play shortstop for us and then move him to second base. No, they told him.
Yeah.
I said, this is what we have this guy at shortstop. We think he's going to be a star, and he might be. but we need somebody to play second base, and we want you to play there. He knew what he was getting into.
Speaking of stars,
yeah.
The Ohtani story really is the story of Major League Baseball, isn't it?
Oh my God,
it might be the story of professional sports.
Well, you know, neither of us was around for the Babe Ruth era, but anybody who follows the history of baseball knows that Babe Ruth started as a pitcher, and was pretty good, made it to the major leagues as a pitcher, but then became the greatest home run hitter in the history of the game at that time and for a long time thereafter. That is so rare. I'm trying to think. I mean, there have been a few guys who started as pitchers and then converted to outfielders. But boy, it's really rare.
I'm not comparing Ohtani to Rick Ankiel.
Well, but that's one name that comes up, right?
Yeah. But hold on. He's doing it at the same time, Bob.
That's what I'm trying to get at, time. John.
Holy smokes.
Historically, this is unprecedented. To be allowed, to be good enough to play at the major leagues as a pitcher and as an outfielder, as a hitter, is unprecedented. To be able to do it where you have made the all-star team in both spots is unbelievable. And he did. He leads the major leagues in home runs with 31. And he's one of the best pitchers in the game. Well, holy crap. How is that possible? And I wonder if the system in Japan plays a significant role in this. And I don't pretend to know the answer. I know in North America, a guy wouldn't be given that opportunity.
Right.
Would not be given that opportunity to be good at both positions. You're either a pitcher or you're an everyday player.
And that would have happened, gosh, in Little League.
I guess.
I mean,
with Ohtani.
No. I'm suggesting.
Oh, the last time a North American guy
sure. At a certain point, when you're, you know, not Little League, but you're 14 years old, some guy comes to you and says, "Okay, you have to decide: are you going to be a hitter or are you going to be a pitcher?"
Guaranteed.
But maybe what Ohtani's doing is going to have some, local coach say, tweak it and say, hey, maybe we should try it. You know, because listen, we all have seen it as kids. We all saw it with our own kids. We've witnessed it with other people's kids, that the best player was a pitcher and a hitter at a certain point. But they're forced to make a choice.
That's
now
right.
The question becomes, with Ohtani, in the long term, are we going to see a change in that?
Well, you mean he'll have to make the choice?
No,
the choice
that
will be made.
No, we're going to see 5 years from now. Are we going to see a pitcher slash hitter come out of Virginia Tech who was never forced to make the choice at 14, 15 years old, went to college, played college baseball and got drafted? Are we going to see that 5 years from now?
I don't know. I mean, maybe this is just one of the most extraordinary athletes we will ever see.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe this speaks of, as you said, and as I said, the notion of there is a time in most athletes' lives where they're the best at everything they do. And in baseball, where you get a chance to do two specific things, hit and pitch, there's lots of those guys out there. There's lots of guys in Little League that do that. There's lots of guys probably in high school baseball that still do that to some degree. But as you move up the chain, that possibility becomes eliminated.
Why?
History.
Right. So that's what I'm saying.
They think it's not possible to do this.
Right.
Now here's a guy who has done it. Does that open the floodgates?
That's my point. I agree.
I don't know.
But we're not going to know for 5 years.
Or more.
Yeah, or more. Now, the other thing is, how many major league teams have put a scout on a plane to Japan
Yeah, see if there's more Ohtanis.
To see if there's more. Not necessarily in the Japanese major leagues, but in the developmental leagues in Japan.
I think the Japanese league now is scouted as intently probably as college baseball here is.
But what I'm saying is that I agree, because I'm sure that every guy has roster.
Are you suggesting now there are teams out there saying, okay, is there another Ohtani, meaning a guy who can pitch and hit? I don't think so. Baseball is a stodgy, slowly evolving sport. You know, if we look at Billy Bean in the Oakland A's and the kind of dramatic change that he made, most organizations went down that road kicking and screaming, and it took them a long time. There weren't many organizations that jumped on the Billy Bean philosophy and the cyber metrics and said, this is the wave of the future.
Yeah.
So I don't see that. And they've been scouting Japanese baseball for a long, long time. There are a lot of Japanese players in the major leagues, and there would be more if the relationship between MLB and the Japanese league.
Right. But listen, maybe there's somebody in the DR. Maybe there's somebody there that can do it. I mean,
they're not going to let the guy do
it. They're not going to let the guy do it in Iowa. They may let him in the Dominican Republic, and they may let him in Japan.
Yeah.
I would have let you pitch and hit, Bob. Now, you wouldn't have got the ball out of the infield, but I still would have let you hit.
Oh, no. I was a pretty good hitter. I was only an ordinary pitcher.
Okay. Well, I still would have let you pitch once.
Although I did strike out John Mayberry at the Blue Jays fantasy camp.
Oh, no, you did.
Yes,
I did. Did he have a blindfold on her?
No, he did not. Threw him a nasty splitter.
Oh. Next week, by the way, folks, next week on the show, Bob's going to show us how to throw a nasty splitter. So,
well, I'm not as young as I once was, but I can show you how to throw a splitter.
No, save it. We need to hype it up.
Used to be called a fork ball. Remember that?
Right, sure. Bruce Sutter, fork ball.
Yeah. And then somebody decided it was called a splitter. It's the same pitch. I don't get it.
Okay.
As we sit here and chat, Shapovalov, I think, is on the court.
Yes.
Oje Aliassime will play later on today.
It's quite a story with the, we had spent all of our time really hoping that Bianca Andreescu would be our flag bearer of professional tennis.
And this is the essence of the conversation I want to have. Look, it's fantastic that these two still young guys. Well, Oje Aliassime is like 20, and what's Shapovalov, like 22, 23?
Yeah. Okay, I was going to say 24 at the latest, but yeah.
Maybe. It's fantastic. Two Canadian players in the quarterfinal at Wimbledon. Never happened before, right?
Nope. Not on the men's side.
So here's the interesting thing. How many times have we had over the last 10, 15 years seen flashes that we thought would be comets?
Well, Milos.
Raonic. No, why am I blanking on her name?
Jeannie
Bouchard.
By the way, Denis Shapovalov's 22.
There you go. 22 and 20 years old. We have seen a bunch of players, Raonic, who people thought had a chance to be, you know, top three, top four in the game. Now, on the men's side, that has been pretty difficult considering who the three best players in the world were and used to be four. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, they get to a point and they don't get any further. And the question now becomes Shapovalov or Oje Aliassime. Is either one of these capable of being that guy? I mean, they both are capable of being top 10 players.
Yeah.
But we all know that eventually the geezers that have been at the top of this sport, Nadal, Federer, Djokovic, are going to have to quit.
Well,
they're going to have to.
In fact, you know, I mean, Shapovalov beat Andy Murray.
Well, he was the fourth guy, right?
Right, he was. And actually, just as an aside, the amount of maturity that Shapovalov showed at the end of the match, to me, speaks volumes of this guy as a person.
Well, I think he's a lovely guy. I don't care about that, though. I mean,
well, I know, but I think that I think with maturity, and I think that that stated maturity helps a guy when he gets into that prime, those prime years of playing the game.
Sure, it does. And understanding, you don't have the talent being a nice guy.
But you need a killer. You need the killer instinct first.
Well, whatever you need. Yeah. You know, and I'm not saying he doesn't have it. I don't know if he has it.
Yeah.
And I don't know if Oje Aliassime has it. But you know that the tennis guys in the U.S., the McEnroes, et cetera, who are Chrissy, who call all these major matches, they have fallen in love with Canadian tennis players in the past and mm-hmm. said, this is the next great player. And they haven't come even close to being the next great player. Have essentially fallen off the map. Now, whether it's Bouchard with the distractions of being a very attractive young lady and the ramifications of that, the fact that maybe she just had a spark in her career and really wasn't that good. Raonic is mostly because of injuries.
Too much too soon. Too much too soon. Not on the court, off the court. Too much too soon.
Oh, I think you're 100% right. But it distracted her.
Sure.
But I can't sit here and honestly say that she had the goods to be a great player.
Yeah.
She played well for a really very short period of time. Mm-hmm. And her career is basically over.
And Milos got to a certain point. I mean, and I am not a kinesiologist, but I'm not sure. Was his body built to be a tennis player?
Well, I don't know that. I mean, I'll tell you one thing. When he started, he was a one-hit pony. He had the best serve in the world.
Sure.
And nobody could get it back. And he won. He didn't have to break very often. He was not that good on the ground game. It was okay, but he improved his ground game dramatically. But people started, like anything else, you show a guy 100-mile-an-hour fastball, first time you see it, you can't hit it. Second time you see it, you still can't hit it. 10th time you see it, doesn't look that fast. And they started to do better against Raonic's serve, but injuries.
Yeah, his body broke down. That's what I mean about his body. His body just broke down.
Well, I don't know why. I mean,
well,
do you need a certain size? Look at Federer is,
Federer
by comparison, a mesomorph. You know, he's a normal size.
Federer's a physical god. I mean, come on.
Well, okay, but he's not overpowering. He's at almost 40 years old. He's still quick. Yeah. He could still win this thing. Yeah. It would not shock me. But he's more of a stereotypical tennis player's body.
Yep, yep.
And maybe that's what you need to survive.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we have left hockey for last, and we'll take another break and then come back. And we're not quite ready for the postmortem.
No.
But we might be only a little more than 24 hours away from doing that. We'll do that when we continue back after these. And so we are down to game four. And, well, 1942?
Yep.
Toronto Maple Leafs?
Yes, sir.
Down 3-0 to the Detroit Red Wings.
Mm-hmm.
And 1-4 straight.
They did.
And it hasn't been done since.
Not in the final. It has been done in three other series previous to a final, but not in a final. That's the only time in a final.
All right. So is that relevant?
No, it's not relevant at all.
Well, no, I think it is relevant. I think it actually is relevant because I think when you get to a final, you know, funny things can happen with two mismatched teams, and a bad team can look good for three games. And then all of a sudden the good team goes, wait a second.
Well, but that's not the case here.
Well, no, when you get to the final, you pretty much know what you got. You don't have any real shocking upsets usually in a Stanley Cup final. Right.
Yeah. I mean, Montreal had its chance to win game two and couldn't. That was the best game they played in this series and could not beat Tampa, who played their worst game. And that's a little harsh, but their least good game of the series. And then in game three, when Montreal, you know, scored a goal to cut the lead in half in the first period, they put the pressure on Tampa for about 8 minutes, and Tampa just swatted them aside. And that proved to me that last half of the first period was the time you said, oh, this is Tampa can beat anybody right now. And that to me was what the indication of how good Tampa was. And then they didn't score any goals, but Montreal threw everything at them. Montreal tried their damnedest and could not beat Andre Vasilevskiy.
Well, okay. I don't know where else you can go to analyze this, because in my mind, all of this was sitting right there. It was predictable. And most Canadian prognosticators, and I must confess, you included,
yes,
fail to see this, fail to recognize that the Montreal Canadiens were not going to beat Tampa. Tampa is not just a good team. They're a great team that has proven over the years how good they are, mm-hmm. and have now reached the point where they know how to win.
Win any way.
Any way they want.
Yeah,
you can play however you want. They'll play whatever you want. You want to play rough, they'll play rough. You want to play speed, they'll play speed. You want to play defense, nobody's better. You want to play offense, they got plenty of guys to put the biscuit in the basket. And they're coached by a really smart coach, mm-hmm. who, I don't want to say lets them play, maybe has taught them, let those guys figure this out. We're just going to be us. And I guess my point is, did nationalism, as so often happens in this country, prevail when people were picking who's going to win the final? This great desire for anything Canadian to succeed. And I'm not critical of it.
Oh, no.
I just want to recognize that we are so insecure in this country.
You think? What do you mean by that?
We're so insecure that we would rather root for a team that we hate that happens to have some kind of maple leaf on its ass than pick the right team.
Yeah, and I by the way, I did not pick Montreal to win because I'm a nationalist, which obviously,
well, you can say that, but because I
picked against Montreal the first three rounds and kept losing. So
you're going to lose four in a row now.
I know. I thought there was something innate about this team that got me through the three rounds of playoffs, saying, well, if I pick them again, I'm going to look like a fool again. Cause that's what they did. They made lots of people look like fools through the first three rounds. And it was less about Tampa and more about Montreal and the way they played. The problem was at every position on that 20-man roster, Tampa's better. And it's not that we didn't see it. It's just that we thought that there was that Cinderella philosophy that Montreal could will their way through a really good team. And they obviously at this point can't will their way. And that's why I picked Montreal, because I did think that Shea Weber and Corey Perry and Carey Price could weather the storm and get them through it. And then their young guys, Caulfield, Kakumeni, Josh Anderson, Nick Suzuki, I thought that they might be able to play at a certain level. And quite frankly, other than Suzuki, everybody else has been outperformed. Everybody's been outperformed.
Well, there's a million things I could say, but they'd all be derogatory towards the dum-dums that follow hockey and make these selections, but I'll refrain for the time being.
Yeah, and you know, listen, it's funny, you know.
It's not over, you know.
No, I'll tell you what, though.
I think it's over, but it's not really over.
This two-day break, having been through it a lot of times, like 30, more than 30 times in my career, this two-day break is agonizing for everybody in Montreal. Everybody, because you get in a rhythm, you have it, and you'll get tired so much quicker with an extra day off, even if you're not playing.
Well, why is this a Montreal problem and not a Tampa problem?
Well, no, I wonder if it won't hurt Tampa more than it hurts Montreal, frankly.
Get to that. I mean, I don't have any idea.
Yeah. Well, having lived it, and you walk, like when they walk into the rink today, people are going to say, oh, thank God, I'm exhausted and I didn't do anything for 2 days. And the play, and if you're talking about that, the people around the game, imagine what the players think.
Well, I don't know what it is this year, but under a normal circumstance, you would have been into your 100 and somethingth game of the year.
Yeah.
And
now you're into about, 75, 76 games.
So. Whatever. So, I mean, I think you want to get it over with and go home and pull out the golf clubs, you know?
Yeah.
And especially the fact that we're in July.
Did you see what the mayor of Tampa said?
The next season is supposed to start, you know, in September.
You see what the mayor of Tampa said?
I have no idea what he said.
She said that it would be great if Tampa lost game four, so they come home and win it in front of the home fans in game five.
I'll tell you, the thought crossed my mind too.
Well,
but you're a professional team. You're not going to roll over.
You're not leaving it. You're not allowing any team to get off the mat.
You'd like to win it at home. You'd like to let the fans celebrate in Tampa. Lord knows they've had enough to celebrate in Tampa the last while with their sports teams.
Yeah.
But you're not taking that chance.
Well, you said on Friday you thought it was over on Monday. So.
Well, I didn't say Monday. I said it was over.
Oh.
Is what I said. Right. I don't know. I don't know whether it's four or five. I don't see any reason why Montreal will win tonight.
Tell you what, Carey has to be
perfect. Carey has been horrible. I mean, he hasn't even been ordinary.
He's been perfect. He has to be perfect tonight.
But let me finish. You could make the argument that he almost single-handedly won the first three series. Not that the rest of the guys didn't do their part, but without Carey Price doing what he's done historically many times, who knows? Do they beat the Toronto Maple Leafs even in the first round? I don't know. Do they beat Vegas in the third round? I'm not sure. But he has not been that guy in the first three games of this series. Now, is that because he's off a little bit? Is it because Tampa's that much better? I don't know.
Tampa has thrown more bodies at the front of the net in the first three games of this series than Winnipeg, Vegas, and Toronto did in three combined series.
Yeah.
That's the difference. If Carey sees it, he can stop it.
Yep.
And right now he has not been able to see as many. The other thing is, and watch this in game four. I think the number is that the Tampa has scored 13 goals in the first three games. Nine have involved defensemen. We don't talk enough about how active the Tampa Bay Lightning defensemen are in the offense of the team. Whether that's Ryan McDonough or Chernak or Hedman or Sergachev or even Jan Ruta.
Well, what's interesting too is that the series before for Montreal against Vegas, same thing. The Vegas defense that scored the goals.
Well, Pietrangelo and Martinez, they were very good. But you're right. But this is one where every time there appears to be something, you know, the Tampa comes across the offensive blue line, you know, it's not just three forwards or two forwards. It's there's a defenseman in that mix too.
Yep.
And that's the aggressive nature, I think, that that Tampa has put into this that makes them that much more dangerous in the offensive zone.
Would you like to tell the folks who we'll have tomorrow? Or would you like to keep it a surprise?
No, we're going to have Keith Olbermann tomorrow.
All right, good. We love Mr. Olbermann.
Well, we're going to see what's on Keith's line. He wasn't very happy about the fireworks in New York Harbor last night. So,
were fireworks here in my neighborhood last night, too?
Last night? Well, you live in the rich American area of Toronto.
That's not American area of Toronto.
Well, who are you?
Well, yes, I'm, you know. But I didn't light off fireworks.
You better not.
I didn't do it on July the 1st, and I'm not going to do it on July the 4th. And July 1st, of course, fireworks are going off all over the place in the city.
I know.
And I get that. And then last night, I went into the backyard and at about 9:30, and boom, 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 boom. I thought, what the hell? The leftovers?
Drake. It's Drake.
Well, Drake's a Canadian. Why would you light off fireworks on the July the 4th?
Maybe he just had some extra. Maybe he had some extra.
Do some research, dig into this, and report back tomorrow, if you will, please.
No, I'll leave it to Olbermann to bitch and complain about it.
We thank you for watching or listening, as the case may be, and we hope to see you back here again tomorrow for John Chan and Bob McCallum. See ya.